Peace be upon you, and welcome to this week's edition to Pathway to Peace, a show which takes an analytical look at the current issues and trends affecting us all, trying to find the answers to problems that affect our political peace, economic peace, and perhaps the noblest of them all, inner peace. Ramadan is more than just abstaining from food and drink. It's a time of introspection, community, and profound connection with the divine. In this week's episode of Pathway to Peace, we'll be exploring conversations from previous episodes that highlights the deeper essence of Ramadan, uncovering its timeless wisdom and unravelling the layers of meaning and how it can affect all layers of society. In our first clip, taken from the show Ramadan, a Non-Muslim View, which first aired on the 9th of May 2021, the presenters take a look at the non-Muslim perspective of what this month means. What are their impressions and what does this month mean for them? We explore that those that have attempted to fast and see whether they have achieved a sense of inner peace. The presenters were Arif Khan and Sufyan Faruqi. Let's take a listen.
Towards getting the community involved, and one of the organizations that we've reached out to is the police department. I believe it's the Surrey Police Department, and at the Surrey Police Department this year, they started an idea with us called the Fasting Collective, in which over 70 police officers took part in the Ramadan practices. So they would try to fast for one day, some would do it for more. And out of those 70 plus police officers, obviously we've got some sound bites of police officers and their impressions. So the first clip we want to play for you is one from PC James Whelan and his thoughts on fasting and observing a fast during the month of Ramadan.
Hi there, my name is PC James Whelan. I'm an officer over on the east. I'm attached to Moore Valley currently, and today I've been a part of the fasting collective that's been arranged by the inclusion team. It's been a really challenging day in a number of ways I wasn't expecting, actually. I think what it's done foremostly for me is it's providing me with a newfound respect for the Muslim community that do this every year for a month at a time. One day has been a challenge enough. I can't imagine what it's like doing this for a month. I think the biggest thing for me personally has been the caffeine. I've realised I've got quite a worrying addiction to caffeine. I think that this is a really valuable thing to do, because there are some things that you could understand them intellectually. I knew what a fast was. I've got close Muslim friends that have explained to me what goes on each year in that period. But I think there are some things that can only be understood comprehensively if they are experienced, if they are done. And I'd recommend this to anyone that is interested, not only as a sign of support and solidarity with your Muslim colleagues, but also to gain that insight and experience as to what they're doing every year for a month at a time. Thank you.
Yeah, that was PC James Whelan, and we want to say a special shout out and a thanks to him for participating in this initiative. It was very, very brave of people in the community, especially when they're not Muslim, to show that solidarity with the Muslim community. And I found it interesting there what PC James said, Arif, around, you know, doing it to kind of understand what Muslims go through each and every year, and how he felt like there was almost a responsibility to go through it for that very purpose.
Yeah, it's interesting having the police do it, isn't it? I think worth mentioning as well that a member of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, Farhan Hayat, is actually the Deputy Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Lead at Surrey Police. He's been influential in making this really a reality. And, you know, by having someone like that who they can relate to, discuss with, you know, who's one of them effectively, and also Muslim, I'm sure that, you know, played a key role there. So I want to acknowledge, you know, Farhan's contribution here. And I think, like you said, for the police to be effective, not only in terms of, you know, kind of handling and dealing with their own internal employees and colleagues, but actually their job of policing, the more they can understand about faith, the more they can understand what different people are going through, I think the more effective it makes them in their job. And also there's a, you know, it's a good, it's a very positive thing to have people in responsibility, whether that's a police officer or whether it's a CEO of a company or managers, etc., having that proper understanding of, you know, what other people are going through, people that they may be responsible for, or people they have, you know, maybe have a responsibility to enforce law enforcement on, for example. It just adds to that understanding. And actually, you know, for me as a Muslim, if I know that the police officers are taking time to do that and actually understand my faith, etc., it gives me more respect for them as well as individuals. So I think there's only positives that really come from this.
Yeah, and the Ahmadiyya Muslim community in particular for the last few years has really been doing, making a conscious effort to kind of educate the wider society about this whole ritual of fasting. Whereas before it was purely an education effort. Now it's more about engaging, and especially with recent times and the pandemic and whatnot, it's become more of a, first and foremost, it's become a virtual event. So it's called the Big Virtual Iftar, whereas before it was just the Big Iftar, and it was held at the Battle Fatu Mosque in South London. And now it's an event that happens on YouTube. And this year, especially as we've mentioned, we've really encouraged not only people to watch the Big Virtual Iftar, but to actually actively engage in the program, and the way that they do that, and the Surrey Police Department took it to the next level by getting 72 people with Farhan's initiative to go ahead and actually try an attempt to fast. And it was really, really interesting as we watched the Big Virtual Iftar, which is on YouTube for anyone else that is interested in it, to hear a lot of these guests come on and talk about their experiences of fasting and actually having to wake up at 4 a.m. and then having to go to work. Our sister show, The Breakfast Show, which you can hear every weekday morning between 7 and 9 right here on The Voice of Islam, did a segment with some guests that took part in our Big Virtual Iftar program, which is happening on a weekly basis. I believe the next one is on the 12th of May, which will be the last one for this year during the month of Ramadan, because then we have our festival after Ramadan, Eid al-Fitr, coming up on the I always get this mixed up. It's the 14th, I believe, this year. Of
correct.
May.
Yep.
So the Breakfast Show did a segment with some officers from the Surrey Police Department as well, and we wanted to share that with you as well. So we'll play that interview for you now.
Yeah, it was an incredible event to be part of from a Surrey Police perspective. On a personal and professional note, I learned so much. And yeah, it was fantastic. So it started at 4 a.m. with our virtual sahur, which was very special, with the young imam and a lot of the other community and 70 plus Surrey police officers, which was a great turnout. The day began, and we did the fasting collective together. Everyone blogged their stories online and via social media channels. We then attended headquarters to pick up our food pack, which had been made ready for us by the UK Muslim youth. And it was just fantastic, absolutely fantastic day. We then logged back on to have a virtual iftar, which was incredible. It was really special after a very long day fasting and really learning about the community and what people doing Ramadan go through and experience.
Fantastic. Just for the benefit of our listeners, Lucy, if I may come to you, how did you come up with the concept of the fasting collective?
Hello, good morning. Assalamu alaikum. Wishing you all a very happy Ramadan Kareem.
Thank you. Peace be on you too.
Thank you for having us this morning. How did we come up with the concept? So it was at the start of the year, actually. It was during one of our planning meetings that we have. And we sort of sat down and knew that we wanted to do something a little different, potentially a little bit more powerful, I suppose. And so the Fasting Collective was born as a way to connect the lived experience of our Ramadan fasting colleagues to those who are not Muslim or haven't experienced fasting before. So it was an idea, and it just grew and grew and grew.
Interesting. And we spoke about this before, so the 72 officers and staff which you mentioned as well in Surrey Police took part in this event. What was the experience for a lot of the officers and the staff during the day?
If we can go to James on that before we go back to Lucy.
Oh, yeah.
Of course. So I think it was a real mixed bag, and obviously everyone had a totally different experience, depends on their own personal life and what their day job was. But I think for all of us, both on a personal and professional note, we learned so much around, say, what is the experience of Ramadan, what is the experience of fasting itself, and actually it creates that empathy and understanding with your colleagues, especially me as a line manager and one of the leaders. You want to know what your colleagues are going through, and after doing the fast myself, I mean, granted it was only one day, and other people will do 30 days plus, but I feel I can appreciate more what colleagues are going through if they're fasting, the time they've been up in the morning, they're still making time for their family, their home life, coming in and doing a really high-pressured job. They might be running meetings, they might be in an operational position where they're responding to emergency calls, and they may be feeling tired and quite low, but actually it's keeping that positive mindset, really getting in touch, having that time to reflect on everything was, yeah, a real special moment. But I think it really helped to improve understanding, and the experience was just really positive feedback from everyone.
Awesome. Lucy, if I might come to you with the same question.
Yeah, so exactly the same as what James was saying. So when we all got up in the morning, it was this incredible sort of community feel. It was fantastic to be bigger as an individual, to be bigger than something that's just you at that time of the morning, to know that there were so many other people globally that were also awake. And I think sort of, you know, as we went on throughout the day, all of our officers and our staff were sharing their experiences, whether it was tagging it online or emailing us their thoughts in sort of little written or audio blogs. And everybody was just so positive, was just so proud to be involved in the initiative that we were putting together. And then when I went over to one of our hub stations later in the day to meet with some of our colleagues and to distribute the food parcels that had been so kindly put together for us, everybody was just so happy. And even behind sort of all of our face masks, you could see everybody's sort of eyes were just crinkled with joy at what they had done, what they had achieved, and sort of at being part of something that was so much bigger than themselves. And it was just so much gratitude for that. And it was really quite remarkable.
James, you already mentioned that, you know, a lot of your colleagues and yourself, when you took part in it, you know, it kind of gave you a different perspective. How did this affect your mindset, your thought process towards Muslim colleagues and communities, you know, who do 30 days of fasting, you know, during the month of Ramadan?
Just total and utter respect and kudos to the Muslim community and particularly my colleagues. I say it just really enhanced my understanding. And yes, it's about the fasting, but me, I did some research around Ramadan and what the bigger picture is. And yes, you've got the fasting, but that's just one aspect, isn't it? And yes, there's the food, but it's the water aspect, but also just around reflection, trying to stay calm, do some reading, maybe engage in some prayer, and keeping that positive mindset, not getting involved in any confrontation. I felt for myself, actually, it gave you that time to sit back and actually realise the time you might make taking a cup of coffee or going to get some food, but actually that time could be better spent either having some reflection, having some well-being or headspace, or spending time with a colleague or doing a different meeting. So it just really opened my mind to sometimes sit back, have a think, and have that time to yourself to really reflect. I think that's what was quite special, and that really came through, as Lucy said, on the virtual suhoor and the iftar later on. Everyone sharing their experience just made you realise how special that was, being part of this bigger community, knowing this is going on with thousands, millions of people around the world. It's quite incredible.
You already mentioned the key words that I was going to ask, which was about self-reflection. Do you think this is something do you think fasting kind of assisted you in self-reflection? And do you think that's something you or your officers will kind of take it on as a habit for future purposes?
I think so. I'd love to see things like this done in the future. I know Lucy and Pran have got some amazing ideas for Surrey Police to improve us as an inclusive force and creating this cohesion. So I think there's definitely more work to be done on that larger level. But I think individually that is definitely happening. Speaking to colleagues around the force and just for myself, since doing that one day of fasting, I've now gone on to actually just monitor more what you're eating, what you're drinking, and just sometimes taking that, that headspace time, I think it definitely can play a part in your daily life moving forward.
Fantastic, fantastic. Because that's the real purpose of Ramadan. It's not just fasting, but to learn new habits which can improve your mental and physical well-being. That's the whole purpose
absolutely.
Of it.
With the spiritual well-being. And I think that's another, like I say, touching the great benefit. Yes, there's the spiritual and religious aspect, but also around just that well-being, your mindset, also that physical benefit from fasting is huge, isn't it?
Fantastic. Lucy, how do initiatives like this collective impact on community cohesion? Because that is a word which I think doesn't get spoken about enough. So, and this is not just, this isn't just a report or just words. This is an actual action that took part. How did it help in community cohesion?
Well, I think our hope with any initiative like this, whether it's to explore a particular faith, disability, sexuality, is that it really gives the opportunity for people to walk in the shoes of another. And I think within the world of inclusion and diversity in particular, we so often hear that people are really, really worried to get it wrong, to offend, to say the wrong thing or to do the wrong thing. And I think that by breaking down these barriers that are either self-imposed or whatever, and just encouraging those everyday conversations, whether it's with another colleague who looks at life a little bit different to you, it just helps to build that inclusive culture, whether that's internally or whether that's within our communities, which really then drives fundamental change. And you may have seen in late 2020 that our Chief Constable launched the Police Commitments, which are a series of promises that we have made to our communities, to our force, and also to our people. And it sets out how we serve Surrey until 2025. And sort of we want running initiatives like this, it just reinforces those commitments, and it ensures that everyone who is within Surrey is acknowledged and is respected. And sort of touching on what James was saying there, I've spoken to some of our non-Muslim officers who have actually chosen to fast for the whole of Ramadan.
Oh, wow.
And to use his words, he said, if I don't understand what it feels like to experience the fast of Ramadan, how can I effectively police, but also how can I effectively support my fasting colleagues? And I think that summarises it so succinctly for me.
Well, do you think that...
In our second clip, taken from the show Ramadan, Achieving Peace in the Home, which first aired on the 26th of April 2020, during the pandemic lockdown period, the presenters look into achieving peace in the home, especially during such tumultuous times. What are the aims and purposes of Ramadan? What are the challenges? Are just some of the questions that were asked. The presenters on this episode were Sarah Ward, Hafia Khan, Reem Shreki and Shazia Bhatti. Due to social distancing rules at the time, only the show's anchor could be in the studio, and so we apologise for some of the audio quality captured via the phone.
What did you say? So, say you don't have the financial resources, what kind of other things could you do to give that sadaqah? You mentioned sadaqah, which is like charity, and we know that the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, peace be upon him, he said... even a smile is a form of charity. So, for those families who can't give, money, what else could they possibly do as a charity to help their own inner peace or to earn some blessings? What other things do you think?
Well, I think these are the things, and I think, we've discussed this a lot, but one of the most important is a smile. So maybe when you are in your isolation, your social distancing, but you go out for a walk in the evening and you see somebody else walking, even if you have to stay 2 meters away from them, you can smile at them. That's one way to give your charity, give them a good feeling. They say other things that the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, used to say was, for example, removing things from the road, sort of thorns and bones. Now a lot of people are walking around, so you might find things on the road you can move. That's a form of charity as well. Shopping for other people, that's a form of charity. You're helping them out. Even if they're giving you the money to do it, it might be something that you can do. So that's a form of charity. Any kind of help... any kind of action where you can help another in some way, that is considered charity.
which I think also includes the emotional support that you can give people, even if you can't be with them physically, but a phone call or a message or something just to let them know that, that you're thinking of them. Because I've found that, you know, given that I've got more time at the moment, I'm not rushing about all over this. I am catching up with people, making sure people are okay over the phone. And I think that that really helps the emotional support. And, you know, as Afia was saying, smiling at people on the road when you're going for your daily walk is so nice, because it brings that sense of community and that we're all in this together and we can't do anything physically to help each other. But a smile goes so long. It's such a long way.
And
that's why the Holy Prophet of Islam, peace and the blessings of Allah be upon him, said the good word, a good word is an act of charity. So like Shazia is saying, to text, you know, good words or to comfort someone by phone or by, so it, this in itself is an act of charity.
Absolutely. And I think we're going to come back and speak a little bit more about that later. And I know for myself, for example, that when it's the clapping time at 8 o'clock, everybody's clapping. That's something that's free, but it, the atmosphere is so nice. You open your front door, you're clapping. It's a communal time. But also I sort of made an agreement with myself that after I've done clapping, I will then check in with people that perhaps I haven't spoken to in a while, and I'll just reach out to people. And that made me feel better, actually. When I reached out and contacted other people, even though it's just through a text, I felt better about that. And I think that that is good for individuals to have that sort of habit of helping others in whatever way, even if it's not financial, at least they can do something. I wanted to now just spend a few minutes talking about mental health, because as we know, we've talked about before on Pathway to Peace, praying and meditation and searching for that inner peace is designed to help to give you a mental health well-being, a sense of wellness, a sense of balance, that in times of distress and trouble, praying is like a solution and it can give you a bit of calm and it can help you in a lot of ways. But I just wanted to talk about the mental health impacts of lockdown and how Ramzan might, you know, how they might feature in a Ramzan that's spent in these conditions. So I do want to look at the negative and the positive. I think it's important to understand both. But perhaps if we start, Shazia, with the negative, what do you think the negative impacts of this kind of lockdown Ramzan might be?
I think lots of people at the moment are very anxious about their health, about other people, about what's going to happen in the future. You know, where in the past a little cold you may have had or a little cough, people are getting very anxious about these symptoms, worrying that they have caught this virus. And, you know, the anxiety and the stress about the future. And, you know, some people that are completely alone may find it quite hard to be in isolation. You know, we have our families with us, and so we have somebody else to talk to within our own household. We also have concern about other family members who may be elderly and who may be, you know, we can't go and help them or do as much for them as we would normally because we can't actually go into their houses. We may be able to drop shopping and things off for them. But it is quite an anxious time at the moment for lots of reasons, as I've said.
And you mentioned about isolation and concern of it, and I think these are kind of, everybody can understand that, and they're kind of something that everybody has on their mind at the moment. So perhaps in the past we've had things, you know, where people who feel anxious, maybe other people didn't share that anxiety, but the things that you've mentioned there, Shazia, I think they're quite universal, and I think everybody understands those anxieties. And I've seen a lot written in online articles and so on that actually for people who do suffer from depression and anxiety, this situation seems to have made their emotional state a little bit better. That actually knowing that everybody is feeling the same way, that collective understanding, that collective empathy has actually helped some people feel a bit better, which was interesting to note. Reem, what do you think perhaps the positive impacts of a lockdown Ramzan might be on mental health?
I think, you know, the community feeling, we feel it now so much. So that, as you said, that it is collective suffering. That's why the community came together in the most beautiful way. We see support from everyone. So you have in your post that, please, if you are self-isolating, we can do this and this for you. So we see that we become really one. And I think this is the biggest positive of the lockdown.
Yes, and interesting that collective feeling is coming at a time when we perhaps might have looked in the mosques for it, and now we're finding it in the wider community.
Right. And so there is no rush to do anything, to go to school, to go to work. So you have relaxing time at home. So I think also this is another positive element.
I think just not having that morning rush in the morning to get the kids ready, get yourself ready, go, you know, how many times I arrive at work already stressed because there was a traffic jam or something, whereas now I just log on, have my cup of tea and I'm good to go.
Yeah, exactly. But I just want to mention also in regard of this, the Islamic, you know, guidance, that there should be no evil omen in whatever your circumstances is. That's why the Holy Prophet of Islam said, no evil omen, but I am pleased with the good omens. So we know in by fasting, we are gaining the pleasure of Allah. So when you have this goal in front of you, every difficulty and every negative element will turn into positive, because you have that highest goal which you want to achieve during the month of Ramadan. So the Holy Prophet of Islam, peace and the blessings of Allah be upon him, stated that God Almighty says, every deed of a person is of his own sake, except for observing fast. Fasting is observed for me, for my sake. Here is Allah the Almighty who is speaking. The Holy Prophet, peace and the blessings of Allah, said there are two blessings which many people lose. They are health and the free time for doing good. So now we have a lot of free time and we have to focus how to make use of this free time to, you know, give more to our community, to our family, so whatever we can reach.
Absolutely. And Hafia, do you think that there's any more that you want to add about what fasting means to a person in Ramadan?
Well, I think, I mean, in terms of fasting individually, I mean, we are talking about the community aspect as well, obviously, looking at how as a community we build together. But the basic aim of fasting is to please Allah, like Reem just said, and we have to look at how we can self-reflect and look at ourselves and what we can do in order to improve our own relationship with Allah as well during the time of fasting. So I think, you know, that's the main essence of what we're supposed to be doing. And in terms of just linking back to sort of the positive aspects regarding mental health, this whole idea of not having to rush, this whole idea of, you know, like you said, in the morning you can just get up and have your cup of tea. And I think that it may be that during this month that people that did have very difficult working hours, jobs, that may have found it more difficult to fast when they're working, it may be that by the grace and help of God, that they are able to fast because they don't have that rush, because they don't have that, I have to get out, I have to do this, I have to do that. And being able to be at home may assist them in being able to keep the fasts, which I think is quite a positive thing. And that affects your mental health, because if you've achieved it, that will make you feel good as well. Mm. Pleasing Allah, but also that feel-good factor that I was able to keep a fast this year. You know, that you may not have been able to do otherwise.
Yeah, it's that goal setting and that trying to aim to do.
In our final clip, taken from the show Ramadan, A Force for Tackling Addictions, which first aired on the 2nd of May 2021, we interview consultant psychiatrist Dr. Shakil Ahmed, who examines the prospect of, through the act of fasting and self-reflection, one can wrestle and overcome their personal addictions, drawing upon the Islamic theory of reformation and morals, and how it can be applied into daily life. Let's hear what he had to say.
On kind of tackling addiction, or either from Islamic or medical kind of point of view, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, there two slightly different questions, although I'll try to bridge them,
sure.
because I think it is important, and I think you're right in trying to put them together. But before I do that, let me just set the background or put it into context that addiction is or dependence has some key features to it. The key features would be a person feels some kind of a compulsion to use the substance or to do that habit regularly. And then they're likely to develop a tolerance to the substance, which would mean that the same amount of substance used would not have the same effect after having used it for a certain time, and they would want to keep increasing the amount they would use to have the same effect. So that's tolerance. And another key feature for addiction would be withdrawal symptoms experienced when the substance is stopped. So if a person used to, say, using heroin or alcohol regularly, they're dependent on it. If they did not drink or did not use heroin, they're likely to have certain physiological and psychological symptoms due to drug not being available to their system. They've got so used to it. Yet another key feature is restarting of using the substance after having been able to stop it for a while, after having detoxed from it. So it's like a chronic relapsing condition.
Right.
In fact, many studies have demonstrated that up to 3/4 of the people come back to their substance of addiction after having stopped it, after having undergone some treatment and a detox.
Right.
And the most important, which would also begin to bridge the gap between a scientific way of treating it and an Islamic way of treating it, is the functional impairment. So a person becomes dependent and their use is such a big priority, the use of the substance becomes such a big priority in their lives that they are then less able to perform their original responsibilities, either as a family member or the job that they were employed for, or any other social responsibilities or civil responsibilities. And that's where you begin to think that somebody's use has become a problem, or we would call them in our psychiatric world as a disorder.
Right.
Because there will also be people who take substances in smaller amounts and they don't have this functional impairment, and you would have to accept that as far as their use is going, it's not affecting their lives in any negative way, and therefore we wouldn't be offering treatment to them. So with that in the background, I also want to add one or two other points, which is that all addiction is not anti-religious or a sin, if you want to use a religious phrase.
Mm.
And one example is, for example, a person who has a debilitating physical health problem and has been prescribed certain opiate analgesics, I mean painkillers that have addictive substances in them. And ultimately, over the period of months or years, they've had to use these painkillers. Now they become addicted to this.
Yeah.
And they cannot live without this, even though the original need for it may have gone or may not have gone. So that's a prescribed development of addiction, and that person is not in breach of, as we would understand as Ahmadi Muslims or any religious person from any religious background, that this is, was a breach of God's instruction. However, yes, a lot of addictive behavior can be seen as an act of disobedience to God's guidance, and the prime example would be repeated recreational use of addictive substances. So one of your previous callers was talking about crack cocaine, but then also alcohol and morphine, you've touched on it, or heroin. The people who use it for recreational purposes get addicted to them, end up affecting their lives, their families' lives. They have been in breach of some kind of law, some natural principles, if you want to call them, but also guidance to live our lives constructively rather than for very selfish short-term gratification purposes. And that is where then there are consequences. In fact, the second Khalifa of Ahmadiyya, may Allah be pleased with him, he wrote a very interesting phenomena about this, and he was talking about the sin through physical actions and through spiritual acts, and then describing that sin has physical consequences, because if the natural law that you've breached is a physical act, for example, you've given your body some kind of an intoxicating substance that ultimately is also eroding some of your natural healthy body organs like liver, for example, in the case of alcohol, then you're going to have physical consequences. You're going to develop cirrhosis or other kinds of liver damage, and your health will deteriorate. Similarly, there can be spiritual consequences. So in terms of your ability to relate to your founder, to your family, to be a constructive person, or to be an honest person. So many times we see in our clinics that people with drug problems and alcohol problems ultimately end up on the wrong side of law. That is because they put themselves in a very difficult financial or social situation. They've ended up either stealing or lying or even being violent when they were intoxicated. And so there are spiritual consequences. So what do we do for it? In fact, let me just add a very interesting point before the treatment. I'm sorry I'm taking a bit of your
time,
but I think
please go ahead.
Important.
Yeah.
The effect of drinking on human behavior.
Mm.
If we look at it in evolutionary terms, the distinction between the human species and the previous stages of evolutionary development is the main difference is our intelligence and our consciousness, our awareness of our environment and nature and its principles. And in terms of the biological development, it's the frontal portion of the cortex in the brain, which is strikingly bigger than some of the other intelligent animals' brains. And the frontal cortex of the human, through our studies and neuroimaging and other various kind of researches, what we've found is that some of the basic skills that humans get or activities that stem from frontal part of the brain cortex is abstract thinking, reasoning, being able to plan. So you make decisions that I would do A and B and C, and it'd be better than doing B and C and then A. Motor skills, our movements, our expressions, and our expressive speech. And very interestingly, our social inhibitions and etiquette, how we relate to people so that we are respectful to each other, we are tolerant to each other. And so these are key frontal lobe functions of the brain. What do we see when persons drinking alcohol? They lose their reasoning. They lose their judgment ability. They lose their planning ability. They sometimes lose their motor skills if they're very heavily intoxicated. Sometimes people fall down, injure themselves. They can't balance themselves. They lose their speech if they're very intoxicated. We all know slurring of people who have been heavily drunk.
Yep.
And social inhibitions are lost. People end up behaving in a manner that later when they come out of this influence, they regret. They feel embarrassed of how they behaved the previous evening in the party. So alcohol, in fact, takes us back to a previous level of existence, an animal level of existence, before the humans evolved towards this more sophisticated way of relating to life and our environment. And that is significant because addictions, in fact, are detrimental to us, not just for physical health reasons, but in terms of our intellectual ability and our social function. And we need to be keeping that in mind when we are treading this risky path.
Mm.
Now, having said that, your point was mainly about the treatment or solutions. Initially, what we would do is we would look at the physical health consequences of somebody who's come to us with a substance addiction.
Yeah.
So somebody who has chest problems because they've been smoking very heavily, or liver disease because they've been drinking very heavily, or their vascular system, whatever, their teeth. I've seen people, young people, in their 20s and 30s with half of their teeth gone and the other half with cavities.
Mm.
because they were just not able to maintain their oral hygiene. They spend a lot of their day and night intoxicated. So it's that level of loss of health. And then, of course, risk of infections. HIV is a lot more common, especially when you start going injecting or sexually transmitted diseases due to your the way you lead your lives. So that they have to be treated. A person's physical health becomes a big priority when they have substance misuse problems, and the doctors think of that. You've got to advise them of lifestyle changes. I think your previous doctor touched on this. Harm minimization is a technique, which is when you, if you realize from a person's history that they've tried to give it up, they've not been able to do it, psychologically they don't have the strength or the willpower, then what you do is to help them be educated how to use the drug with minimal harm. And that's called harm minimization approach. Psychological syndromes have to be treated. So people get anxious or depressed. And sometimes these are underlying causes of them starting to take substances. So, for example, someone with social phobia or lack of confidence in social settings may think that every time I'm going to be in a social setting, I must drink some alcohol. That gives me a bit of confidence. A common scenario that we come across. But ultimately, they end up being dependent on alcohol and with all those complications that we've just mentioned.
Yeah.
So you've got to focus your treatment on this social anxiety through the usual psychological methods and behavioral methods, and I wouldn't go into the detail of them.
I was going to say, what's your take on, you hear this kind of term around called going cold turkey in terms of a complete cutoff. I'm wondering, does the principle of fasting within Islam, does that kind of resonate with that? Is it possible that if someone has that will to kind of have a clean break for, say, 29, 30 days, that is enough to kick the habit, to kick the addiction?
Okay, so cold turkey can be utilized effectively if, one, the person's physical health allows you to do it. What you don't want is to stop somebody's drug of abuse if they were going to go into serious physical health complications, like, for example, a status epilepticus, which means lots of epileptic seizures. It could potentially be life-threatening. So you're not going to attempt that. Secondly, that they have the heart status or cardiovascular status that can tolerate blood pressure changes, because the person's bound to have those. So it's those kind of things that you're going to look at. But fasting is a form of detox, and it's slightly different and more sophisticated, in my view, than just cold turkey. Because fasting, for example, somebody who smokes or drinks regularly, and so much so that they go through the day with these, they're going to not be able to do this during the fasting hours, say Islamic fasting, although all religions have fasting and there are different forms of fasting and different durations of fasting. But let's talk about Islamic fasting, which is the daylight hours from sunrise to sunset, and at least the obligatory ones during the month of Ramadan. They're going to go through that withdrawal during the fasting hours, but they're also going to be able to smoke or use their substance after the fasting hours. But what fasting is going to do benefit to them is in two or three ways. One, it's going to help them reduce their cravings. They will gain the confidence that I can actually control and not succumb to my compulsion to use this substance during those hours. That means that I can extend this strength and also overcome it in the longer term. And that's a very good or strong starting point in somebody trying to overcome their addictive habit. Then it also will give them self-control and patience. It's not that they're not going to feel the compulsion during those hours, and they may even go through some of the withdrawal symptoms during those hours. But because they would have gone through it, they would inculcate in themselves a strength of patience. I remember one of the sayings of Prophet Muhammad, may peace and blessings be on him. He called the month of Ramadan as the month of patience in one of his sayings.
Yeah.
And similarly, self-discipline is developed by fasting. So you're not just giving up your substance of abuse, but you're also giving up some of the other habitual habits, your habits that you may be carrying on along with this substance abuse, which may be a bit like immoral practices of some kind. Mm. Gossiping, backbiting, uncontrolled anger. And there are those kind of restraints that come through fasting. As you would know, that if we are fasting and if we feel anger or somebody's being unfair to us, we are not supposed to respond in the same way. We're supposed to say, I'm fasting, peace be on you, mm. I cannot relate to you in this manner.
Yeah.
And again, another of Prophet Muhammad, peace be on him, his saying is, fasting is like a shield. And by shield, he meant that this is against evil behavior. So you're absolutely right. Fasting is giving us that reduction in craving. Our patience is increasing. Our self-discipline is being strengthened. And if we do then utilize fasting in enhancement of prayers, which is also one of the integral things that people fast for, then you can also pray for your own freedom from these afflictions, including addictions.
Mm. Yeah.
And if I want to speak in a very secular way about this, if there is a living God, and if the prayers are sincerely carried out, and we believe that there is a living God who's listening to us and watching us, and similarly, if we do our prayers sincerely, then there's going to be a response. And in Ahmadiyya Muslim community, we have, and in all other religions as well, but we see it in our community members, thousands of examples of people's prayers being listened to in one form or another. I'm not just talking about addictions in this manner.
Hmm.
So fasting for us becomes a jihad, a fight against our own weaknesses, and one of them is our addictive habit.
That's it for this week's edition of Pathway to Peace. We're back same time next week. Thank you for listening. But before we draw this episode to a close, let us reflect on the wise words of the founder of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, Hazrat Mirza Ghulam Ahmad, the awaited Messiah and Mahdi of the latter days, who once wrote the following about the blessed month of Ramadan. During that month, one should discard one's preoccupation with eating and drinking, and cutting asunder from these needs should address oneself wholly towards God. Unfortunate is the person who is bestowed material bread and pays no attention to spiritual bread. Material bread strengthens the body, and spiritual bread sustains the soul and sharpens the spiritual faculties. Seek the grace of God, as all doors are opened by His grace.